In the beginning, Ibiza's ancient wells were sacred places of fertility, life, and renewal, temples to the moon goddess Tanit. But slowly, the people started forgetting, and the more they worshipped the god of the sun, the more the wells began to dry. You're listening to The Wells of Tanit, a podcast celebrating the folklore, mythology, history, and ecology of the island of Ibiza. My name is Joanna Ruby. I'm an artist and puppeteer and the founder of Theatre of the Ancients, and we're about to journey together to one of Ibiza's wells to see what stories it has to tell us. Don't be afraid, take my hand, and let's go and find the Wells of Tanit. The sun has just set here between Balafia and San Lorenzo in the middle of the island of Ibiza. It's October, and I'm sitting next to a jade-green door, which is nestled into the hillside. And if someone told me that a hobbit lived behind this door, I would probably believe them. But I'm going to open the door and see what I find. There's a padlock on it, but it's not locked, so I'm going to open. And inside, there are some steps going down. It's whitewashed inside, but it's very dark. And when I get to the lowest step, I'm standing a couple of inches above an absolutely full well of water, which is basically inside a cave. There are less insects in here than I imagined there would be, and it's actually a very comfortable place to be. I might come and sit in here properly a bit later on. But now I'm going to come outside again and enjoy the last rays of soft light before it gets dark. I'm at the Font de Can Peremuson, and this well I have mentioned in previous podcasts. It's about a kilometre up the track from the Font de Balafia, which is where I recorded episode one. And it is the well which inspired a poem which I recited a little bit from in episode one, called When I Was Furthest from Water, which is a poem which was published into a mini book by my friends Rima and Tom, who are the founders of Hedgespoken Press in Devon, southwest England, which is where I get a lot of my inspiration for these folkloric adventures on the island of Ibiza. And this is also the well which inspired my Ibiza hero of folklore and pagan wanderings, Rolf Blackstad Sr., founder of Blackstad Design Consultancy, an architecture business, who wrote about his journey to this well in, I believe, the 1960s. And I know that I recited this in episode one, but I'm going to just repeat a little bit of it now because I'm sitting right beside the very entrance to this cave. Just above the terrace of the palms was a square stone pool. Standing beside it were three women in black peasant dress, an old woman, a woman, and a girl. Behind them, set into the hillside, was the doorway into a cave. Into the cave, a few steps down, a pool of water, an underground spring. I entered the cave. The scene was dreamlike. My body dematerialized. I vanished to myself. I remember nothing further, not my return journey through the valley in darkness. Now, I returned to this well for a particular reason, actually, because over the summer I neglected it a lot, very rarely came here as I was generally in hibernation from the sweltering summer sun. But I came here about a month ago and I discovered something quite upsetting. As soon as I approached the well along the track, there was just something horrifically wrong. The giant stone container vessel, which is often found beside Ibiza's wells for putting water in to feed the animals, washing clothes, things like that. The giant stone vessel, which has always been next to the door of this well, had gone. And what remained was a very crude foundation of slightly broken up stones and compacted red earth, which was the base of the vessel, looking very crumbled. And I wondered whether the vessel had been damaged and had been removed by the government to be repaired. I really hoped that that was the case. And I wrote to the archaeology department of the government and I just asked them, hey, what's happened to the stone vessel which is always next to the Font de Campere Mousson? And unfortunately, they confirmed my fears and said that it has just disappeared and they can only assume that it's been stolen. And they also told me that it was an ancient olive mill, probably from the Punic or Roman era. And I can only imagine that it has been stolen to decorate a new luxury villa somewhere. And it's just tragically ironic, after everything that I was talking about in my previous episode about cultural appropriation, I thought that I had to come to this well and apologise to it, keeping in mind all of the things that we pondered on in the previous episode. So here I am, feeling that this well seriously needs some love and respect. Anyway, since episode 4, The Wells of Tanet has passed the 600 listeners mark. That's very lovely. I have been sent a crocheted god Bess, the god of dance, discussed in episode 2, I believe, by a lovely woman called Trish Philby in Norfolk. Thank you again, Trish. And I've made some new friends through this podcast. I went on an adventure with Sid. Hello, Sid. On an adventure to find a spring, which unfortunately had dried up, right up in the north, on a private piece of land that she knew of. And we got bitten to death by mosquitoes and scratched by brambles, but we had a lot of fun. So the theme of episode 5 is migration routes. In this episode, I'm going to explain a little bit about how the ancient routes that connect Ibiza and have connected Ibiza with the rest of the world, bringing different materials, substances, ideas, tribes of people, have really shaped the island into what it is. Now, we know a lot about the modern day migration routes, which make Ibiza known in the conventional sense, which is not necessarily the accurate sense. But what about the ones that are less known, less understood, less remembered? So today, I'm going to imagine that I've got an old treasure map in front of me with the island and all of these routes marked on it. And I'm going to get a sharp object, like maybe a shard of glass or a piece of old metal, maybe an old Roman coin. And I'm going to start scratching away at the map. And starting with the modern migration routes that we all know so well, and probably the unavoidable main one is mass tourism, what happens if we start scraping them away and seeing what's underneath? So, would you like to come with me and see what we find? So on my treasure map, the most obvious route glaring at me today is mass tourism. Now, this is the migration route which started, you could say it started to connect Ibiza to the rest of the world in about the year 1966. And these well-trodden routes are continuing to the present day and, in fact, expanding. I think it was announced about a week ago that there are plans to connect Ibiza directly to New York and other locations. So that web of modern-day flight-based migration routes is just expanding, expanding. So on the 15th of July 1966, Ibiza Airport opened itself to international traffic for the first time. And that was when a truly momentous new phase in the island's migration routes started. Last year, 2018, 8.1 million passengers passed through that airport. But I'd quite like to focus on a particular mini route within that web of mass tourism. And that's the route connecting Great Britain to Ibiza, because it has brought a certain kind of aspect of that tribe, that movement of mass tourism. And I think I'm focusing in on the hedonism route, because perhaps for many young people of Great Britain, Ibiza has become a place to undertake major rites of passage. Stag do's, hen nights. Ibiza has become the place for many young British people to experiment with drugs for the first time, to taste freedom for the first time. It is a location of countless tragic accidents, of people falling out of hotel balconies and dying, sadly, too young. And all of this is to do with that strange hedonism route which has been well established between Britain and here. I quote a little passage from the Edinburgh Evening News, Monday the 15th of June 2019. Aggressive stag party on Ryanair Edinburgh to Ibiza flight leaves boy in tears. The Mirror reports that a group of more than 30 men left passengers terrified with their behaviour as they became increasingly intoxicated. A mother, who wanted to remain anonymous, told the Mirror that her son was left in tears because he was terrified and wondered what they were going to do. She said that a couple of elderly people were also visibly shaking due to their behaviour. The mother described the language being used on the plane as disgusting and disgraceful, and that one of the men started punching the wall and kept saying he was going to get out of the plane. Now, as somebody living a fairly different lifestyle to the one that is commonly tasted on the Britain to Ibiza hedonism route, I often try to go in the contrary direction to that flow of hedonistic tourism in the summer season. I often try to get off the island during that time. And occasionally my migration route of exiting the island kind of clashes and collides in a quite amusing way with the migratory route coming in the opposite direction. I often find that if I'm leaving the island in the summer season, I will enjoy a flight in almost near silence. It will often be a full plane, but most people will be looking very, very, very sun-kissed indeed, and will be very somber and generally fast asleep. I imagine perhaps nursing gigantic hangovers. But then in the past, I have returned to the island feeling refreshed, inspired, rested, well away from the crazy hysteria of this little island when it's embracing the summer season. And I will suddenly get a major culture shock when I arrive at a North London airport at 6 a.m. and suddenly find myself surrounded by big groups of men drinking pints of lager and a kind of a frenzied mounting energy. And by the time I board the plane, this energy has built into a sort of a chanting, a kind of a roar of anticipation of some gigantic rites of passage experience which is about to take place 2 hours later when they step on Ibizan soil. And I spend the rest of my journey in acute claustrophobia until I get out of the airport doors at the other side. So now, beginning to scrape slightly away at that very, very well-recognised mass tourism, hedonism, migration route that Ibiza is known for. And I've come to another one, the illegal drugs route. Now, this one, I would say, probably started slightly later than the mass tourism route started. Maybe 1970s, but I'm no expert. And, of course, on an island with a hedonism tourist industry, there must be well-established drug smuggling routes. Again, I'm no expert on that, linking Ibiza with the parts of the world which produce those popular drugs. And I come to a tale which really caught my attention in the media a couple of years ago, the Colombian drug mule story. I know it's not good to kind of take interest in this tale, because I'm sure it produced a lot of sadness and personal upheaval for the people in question and their families and their friends. But I do find it fascinating because it tells the story of two young girls who I would say were on that well-trodden Britain to Ibiza hedonistic tourism route on a normal holiday. And the next thing they knew, they slipped from that route onto the illegal drugs route and ended up in a Colombian prison. And the thing I find fascinating is that that kind of switching over of two very, very separate migratory routes took place on Ibiza, the place where all of these different routes kind of meet and converge. So I quote from the Belfast Telegraph, July the 7th, 2014. Peruvian police have revealed for the first time how drugs mule Michaela McCollum has finally admitted that she did smuggle cocaine for cash after being left broke and homeless on the party island of Ibiza. Explosive new details reveal how the 20-year-old from County Tyrone willingly offered up her services to a South American drugs gang for €5,000 after she met them in a San Antonio bar. She was introduced to the drug cartel through a low-level drug dealer in the Amsterdam bar, who had been asked to find two women willing to traffic the 1.5 million stash of drugs for cash. The model was then flown to Mallorca to meet Scott Melissa Reed, who cops say had a close relationship with drugs lords that they claimed kidnapped and held them at gunpoint. The nightclub hostess made the dramatic confession to prosecutors last year after being told she and Reed would spend the next 15 years behind bars. So I kind of occasionally followed the story and discovered that they've both now been released. But I did find it fascinating that how did a little Spanish island end up being the kind of place where two girls could arrive from Ireland and Scotland and end up in Colombia? Isn't that bizarre? Anyway, I'm scratching another layer off this map, and I am coming to the hippie trail route, which started in about the 1960s. I think it's fairly common knowledge to most people who come here that Ibiza has a bit of a hippie heritage, and that's mostly evident through the hippie markets and also, I guess, the evidence of hippies loitering the public places. And of course, this is because back when the hippie trail brought Westerners from Northern Europe down to India, they started discovering little cheap places to settle for a while or to return to after their trip to India, and Ibiza became one of them. And this has really, really shaped the modern-day identity of Ibiza. It's now a place where you can find yoga centres, yoga teachers, Indian musicians, dancers, clothes makers, traders, furniture makers, jewellery, all very, very much inspired by the Orient and by India. And I recently found a very interesting academic essay online from a man called Anthony D'Andrea, published in 2006 in the Culture and Religion Journal by Routledge. And he kind of explores all of this in an essay called The Spiritual Economy of Nightclubs and Raves, Osho Sannyasins as Party Promoters in Ibiza and Pune, Goa. So I'm not sure I completely understand everything that he's on about. He's got plenty of other essays which go even deeper into this subject, but I think that he's explaining how this hippie trail has kind of infiltrated into Ibiza's nightclub industry. So I'll just quote a little bit from that. Most of these expressive expatriates have been to India, where they report life-transforming experiences. Within the alternative circles of Ibiza, one is recurrently introduced to Osho disciples, sannyasins, and other admirers and habitués of India. During wintertime, they travel to Asia and their western homeland in a semi-nomadic cycle, returning to Ibiza before the next summer when they will work again in hippie markets, nightclubs, new age retreats, therapy circles and other gentrified services for wealthy mainstream dwellers on the island, mainland Spain or Europe at large. While in India, they purchase exotic commodities to be sold in Ibiza's hippie markets. They learn self-development techniques in ashrams, often to be imparted in New Age sessions and retreats back in the West, and they also delve into India's hinterland, often referred to as coming back home or to the womb of Mother India. As a result, even among those who have never been to Asia, the social life of expressive expatriates in Ibiza is strongly informed by an imaginary realm of Oriental exoticism, intertwined with a need for renewing expressive subjectivities. It's a slightly lesser known fact that I think in the 80s there was a spiritual commune following the principles of Osho, Bhagwan Ranish, in the north of Ibiza, and there is a theory which is confirmed by various individuals claiming that when this commune was dissolved because the reputation of said guru fell into disgrace in the 1980s, the commune dissolved and apparently large quantities of the drug ecstasy were left circulating in the north of the island, and they infiltrated into the island's nightclubs, and that was how Ibiza's hedonistic dance industry started. I don't know if that's fully confirmed, but it's an interesting theory. So anyway, let's get the Roman sharp coin or piece of shrapnel and scrape away another layer of the treasure map, and we will find the beatnik route, which started, I would assume, in about the 1950s. Now, the really crucial feature of this route is that now we have dug beneath the surface of Ibiza's air travel migration routes. We are now pre-air travel, and we've arrived at the time when the only way to come to this island was via boat. Now, the writer Clifford Irving, in his biography of Elmir Dori, a famous Hungarian artist who lived on Ibiza and made his money faking works of art by great painters, noted in his writings, "There were beatniks, potheads, artists, writers, actors on holiday, escapees from New York advertising agencies, a couple of Canadian ex-con men, German land speculators, a few rich men, many more poor ones, and even a reported Nazi war criminal whose bull neck, beady eyes and kindness to children made him a caricature of what he was supposed to be." Just to give us a little sense of the kind of individuals who were treading that pre-air travel route to the island before the 1960s. And in the writer Stephen Armstrong's very entertaining condensed history of Ibiza called The White Island, he describes this beatnik route, which I refer to, and says the following. "Because Franco-Spain was still under a UN embargo and few ships docked in Spanish ports, Europeans crossed the continent by train, while the Americans took tramp steamers to Paris or Tangier and on to Barcelona. There they would catch the Jaime Uno, a long, low steamship with one tall funnel and a crane amidships for loading bulky cargo, which sailed overnight to Ibiza once a week. The Jaime Uno's promenade decks and cabins smacked of faded Edwardian glamour. The bar sold absinthe, the powerful, vaguely hallucinogenic aniseed spirit made from wormwood. Determinedly decadent, these young bohemians fell on Van Gogh's favourite tipple, with the result that those faded cabins and promenade were usually swimming in green vomit as the artists caught their first dawn view of Dalt Villa." Oh, it's managed to get completely dark now since I've been talking, so I've switched on the light of my mobile phone to be able to see my writings, my notes. It's nice that I'm in the middle of the countryside on a track which only leads to a tiny ancient settlement, Balafia, and yet I can hear the pleasant sounds of some Dutch people walking down the track and some dogs barking. There's little murmurings of life here this evening. But anyway, I continue. And now we've done the beatniks, I'm going to touch briefly on the pirate routes, because Ibiza is special in that it's the second place in the world which has a monument dedicated to pirates, which is testament to the strong influence of pirates. Ooh, another sign of life passing by. Ibiza has a hugely complex pirate history, And the only other place in the world, apparently, which has a monument dedicated to pirates is the city of Plymouth in southwest England, which has a statue dedicated to St. Francis Drake. And strangely, that is exactly where I lived before I moved to Ibiza. So the reason for the strong influence of piracy in Ibiza's history is mainly because since Ibiza's Arab rulers were overthrown in the 13th century by the Catalans, the island has been under constant attack from ships coming from different parts of the world, but mainly in those times coming from North Africa. And Ibiza developed its own type of pirate, the corsairs, to legally fight off these constant invaders. And the island created its own network of pirate lookout towers, which are dotted around the coast of the island. You can pretty much walk from one to the next and make a complete circumference of the island. And there is also one part of the interior of the island, right in the centre, where there is another cluster of these pirate lookout towers, which in those times would transmit the messages coming from the outer bits of the coast across to the other side of the island so that the whole island could be notified in the case of an invasion. And what would you know? I am about a kilometre from the settlement of Balafia, and that is exactly the location of those central pirate towers. And in fact, just over the side of the track where I'm sat now, there is a house with a pirate tower in its grounds, which sadly was destroyed in a very, very heavy storms that happened a couple of years ago. So you can just see this strange jutting up piece of bare tower on its own, and the rest of the garden is filled with the stones of the collapsed tower. Right, well, I've just got my piece of shrapnel and scratched away a seriously thick new layer of this ancient treasure map of migration routes, which is getting a little thinner now. We've gone through several of them. And now I've come to, some of the really, really interesting routes, which I will refer to as the Moorish and Phoenician routes. And the rough time span of these migratory routes are starting in about the 8th century BC and finishing around the end of the Moorish rule on Ibiza, which is about the 13th century. So here things get interesting because these are ancient trading routes which link Ibiza with the Eastern Mediterranean, the North of Africa, the Middle East and the Far East. And this is the layer, the hidden layer of the treasure map, which most people, when they think about Ibiza, do not know and do not understand. And if I'm trying to show anything with this podcast, it's to communicate to you that this layer exists and it is more than rich and more than complex and more than fascinating. And if you look for the traces of these ancient routes on the island, you will find them everywhere you go. I'm not going to explain anything about these routes. Instead, I'm going to go back to a boat journey that I went on 2 days ago to Ibiza's neighbouring island of Formentera. And I did that to go and visit Evelyn Naon. Since arriving on Ibiza, she has spent about 10 years taking a journey between Ibiza, South Arabia and North Africa to explore these historic bonds between these lands and to convert these stories into a very incredible medium, a simple, accessible, universal medium of perfume. Evelyn Naon Ibiza is her brand of oil perfumes, which she describes as an olfactory journey between Mediterranean and the Arabian Sea. And boy, is she passionate about what she does. Evelyn, hello.
Hello, how are you, Joanna?
How is Formentera for you today?
Formentera today, we have now the end of the season. It's getting really quiet, beautiful time to go to the sea, to swim, to reflect and relax. And I'm really appreciating this time here. So I welcome everybody in Formentera for autumn.
I've only been here for half an hour and it's tranquil, it's golden, sparkling. I can hear the waves lapping just behind us. It's very, very wonderful. It's kind of a relaxing place away from Ibiza, isn't it?
Yes. Honestly, I took this summer to take a break, and I decided to come to Formentera to reset and to think about a new perfume also related to the area. So, yes, it's like a parenthesis, I would say.
So, to start from the beginning, I think, I will say that maybe about 10 years ago, I was in the San Juan market, and I was wandering around, and there was a very chic, minimalistic stall compared with all of the other ones. And I picked up a perfume which looked different from any other perfume that I've seen before, because it looked like a golden magical oil instead of some kind of spray. And I smelt it, and I felt like I never smelt something so exotic, but so filled with something that kind of wanted to communicate something to me, like it wanted to say something familiar to me. And that was your perfumes. For a start, you call them oil perfumes. I feel like your perfumes are almost the opposite of normal perfume, which is something to kind of decorate yourself. Your perfume seems so much more basic and elemental.
Yes, I think the idea with the extracts or working with oil perfumes, it comes from the research I have been doing on the Phoenician trading, and also through my travels through Yemen in 2006, where I discovered a new way that is not new, that is the old way of creating perfumes. We are normally used to have these perfumes with alcohol, but the real perfume, it's an extract, it's not diluted, and it's not harmful for the skin. So the idea started when, in a way, when I was in Ibiza, I was feeling some areas like Buscastel. It reminded me about some areas I saw in Yemen. And the same day, and that was 2014-15, I went to the historic files of Ibiza to research about the Arab history of the island. And yes, there were these Yemeni tribes living in Ibiza in the 10th century, 11th century, etc.
And that's incredible.
Yeah, for me it was like, wow, yes, the same kind of landscape that is a constructed landscape, that is the irrigation channels for agriculture, that they were made in this typical Yemeni style, that is the terraces. So from there, I start to think that I would love to represent the intangible heritage through a way that I can do it, and that way is through my nose, using the nose as a channel to representate botanics, history, communities, and to talk about Ibiza in a different way, trying to preservate and conservate the moments of the history and the populations and the people that were there, that we don't see them anymore. And sometimes people arrive to Ibiza and they don't know about the Phoenicians or the Arabs or all the other tribes that were present on the island.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, when I think about it, you know, I do theatre and I do puppetry because I think that's a very direct way to connect with people's imaginations and emotions. But smell, that is on a completely different level. I mean, my relationship with Ibiza, I think, is primarily through smell, because I remember when I came here as a child, I smelt the pine at night time when we arrived at night on a late flight from London, and that smell was what made me fall in love with this island.
And that's something that you remember all your life, because the sense of smell that is related to the to a specific area of the brain that connects present with past. And you can, for example, you're talking about the pines. Yes, you can smell these pines when you are five. And another time, you smell the pines and your brain just works the way back to the first time you smell that smell. So it's a beautiful way to represent history, to represent anything you want to represent, that you want to put it away from politics, economy or anything like that. It's just intangible. Smell has no religion.
Yeah, it breaks all boundaries. Yeah. It totally does. It's fascinating. So you grew up in Uruguay, but your roots are in these lands which you're connecting, the connections between Ibiza. So this has kind of been a process of you connecting to your own roots as well as to the roots that are connected with Ibiza?
That's a yes. I come from my mom and from my mother, from a Sephardic Jewish family that was expelled from Spain with the Catholic king and queen in the 1492. They were originally from South Yemen, like these tribes of priests that they are named the Kohen or the Levites. That they left with the migrations, that they went to the north of Africa from the south of Arabia, and they populated the area of Spain during the Islamic period. After that, they went to Turkey, and after that, they went down to Uruguay. So it was all the way back for me. I decided first to come to Ibiza, and around 2002, I found a beautiful magazine called Altair, that means... the bird in Arabic, that had all these pictures from Yemen, and that was the start of the journey, because I decided to go to Yemen, this Jewish girl alone, to study Arabic and meet the people there, see what happens, who they are, why there's so many misinformation, and also to find my roots.
Wow. So it was in Ibiza that you discovered these pathways to these places?
Yes. It was in Ibiza. 3 years after arriving, as I have a Spanish passport, I didn't have any paper at that moment. But it was, when I get the papers to live legally in Spain, I'm going to travel to Yemen, I'm going to learn, and I'm going to discover whatever has to be discovered. But then there's many historians from Spain, like Miquel Barceló. He's dead, but he was a big one. Most of his work has been done in the University of New York, and he was studying everything about the aquifers from Ibiza with another archaeologist, that is Elena Kirchner from the UB from Barcelona. And they were the first Spanish archaeologists and historians to connect inside, going to Yemen, to see the same tribes that were here in Ibiza creating the irrigation channels. They went to study them there in Yemen, and they came back to create a lot of information and a lot of research, and that helped me a lot.
Wow, because you know that a lot of this podcast series is inspired by the water systems of the island and the wells, so that's incredible.
Yes, that's connected. Mm. If there's a reason for people stopping in Ibiza to develop, let's say the Phoenicians or the Arabs or the Carthaginians, it's because the island had water. As the Bedouins say, if there's water, there's life. It's basic. The first explorers that they go, at the time were like checking areas that were unknown to them. The first thing they try to find is like streams of water, because after that, anything can happen. They can build, they can plant, they can export, they can do commerce, and everything. Mm.
Yeah, and it seems to be more and more a recognised fact that it was the Arab culture on Ibiza which truly made the most of the water, the fresh water supply of the island, and created all the systems and the wells that we have now.
Yes, if we think a little bit about history on the Sabian Kingdom in the south of Arabia, with all the cisterns created in the area of Mareb and other areas of the south of Arabia, these tribes that were coming here, they were the experts since Sabian times, and we're talking about 6th century before Christ, And they were the experts in the creation of the irrigation channels, channeling all the mountains that they are in the area of Arabia. But then they exported this knowledge through all the tribes that were moving around the north of Africa and then the south of Spain till the area of Barcelona. But the whole Spain has this register of Yemeni tribes, experts in water management. Mm-hmm. And they have been responsible for the creation of this water channeling to introduce different plants like citrus and aubergines and sugarcane. But not only to introduce them, the most important thing is that the Spain rise in commerce during that period because they were doing exports of food like they don't do today. Sorry. But they could, I mean, today. But after the Arabs and the Jewish community left, that area stayed like a little bit unpopulated till today. Mm-hmm. But yes, there was a lot of progress at that period of history.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we've ended up talking about the water system because my podcast is kind of so inspired about the waters of the island and what they represent. And it's made me remember that the last time I really spent time with you was we went for a walk in Buscas del Valle. And that is a place where the Arab water irrigation system, which is still working today, it's amazing, kind of collides with some of the substances which go into your oil perfumes, namely citrus notes.
Yes, yes.
What is the connection between that and these lands which you take your inspiration from?
The citrus was brought from China first through all these routes going from China, South India, the areas of South Oman, and then all the Red Sea commerce. But the introduction of lemon, orange, mandarin, it was not only created to enjoy the fruits, but also to create oils that were used in pampering and perfuming religious ceremonies. And if we remember these Semitic cultures, they give a lot of importance to perfuming the body as a ritual. So it's very important the work on the creation and distillation. You can distillate anything. You can distillate from the flower, from the leaves, from the skin of the lemon. Mm-hmm. And from that, they created perfumes. I always think that the first perfumists, normally they were in the area of Persia and Arabia. Even though today we think it's France, the reality is that Spain was, before France, much more into the perfume industry as a natural perfume industry, using these oils from bergamot, jasmine, and even the pine that you were talking today before. It's a beautiful note to use in the conception of a perfume formula.
Yes, and I mean, although I could talk to you so much about these substances which come from the Arabian lands, but also I know that you're somebody who's very aware of the use of pine by the ancient islanders of Ibiza in ritual and in the home. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes, well, pine is a huge tree in the sense that you can use the leaves, you can use them for anything related with cough, lungs, and flus and everything. So you can use for that the little leaves. You can use them for perfuming the house. You can use them to clean the house. But also the resin that maybe you saw sometimes. I was using the resin from the pine. That was used to work as a candle, to keep the fire alive, as an oil, the resin. And also, it has been used to preserve boats, as a resin to cover the broken parts of the boats or ships. And also the resin is used for like varnishing.
Uh-huh. Yeah? Uh-huh. It's the resin is such a deep sweet smell. It's just the best. I think it's my favorite smell ever.
The resins?
Yeah. And do you think that you've mentioned previously that the people of the island kind of held the pine resin in a sacred way in their earlier life?
Yeah. People, if we go to a like ethnographic or anthropologic understanding of how people were living, we should think that if you are in your house, that maybe it's a mud house with some stones and some wood, and at that time you wanted to clean your house or you wanted to perfume your house, what do? You open the door, that door, and you just check what do you have around you. Mm-hmm. And with these things that you have around you, they used to make ceremonies and rituals. If we remember, women before used to have their babies in their houses, surrounded by other women, and they were burning incense, and they were burning the plants that they have around. Mm-hmm. It was not that mm-hmm. they were going to find something far away. Let's say at that period of the Islamic, period, mm-hmm. people were using what they have around them. And they understand the nature, and they use the nature for these rituals. Mm-hmm. The rituals, we can think about rituals when people are born and when people die.
And I think another really important thing about your oil perfumes is that they transcend gender, because a lot of time in Western society, there's this idea that there are perfumes for men and there are perfumes for women. And that just simply does not apply in your world, and I love that, because that makes complete sense to me. You know, those earthy smells are not suited to a woman or suited to a man.
Exactly. In that way, as I don't come from a French perfuming school, and I'm a kind of a rebel, that's why I have been living in Ibiza. The formulation of the perfume is based on an ethnobotanic research that I do from an exact period of time in a place. So, in that period, in that place, in that area, which plants we have. So plants are not female or male. And the formulation is completely separated from what we think is for girls and boys. Mm-hmm. I don't operate from that area. I operate from choosing this place, that moment, and the plant around the story that I'm telling. Yeah. And from that, I create. When I create, it just happens.
Yeah.
It's not like we should mix this with this because that goes good and is the trend on the perfume industry. I don't know about that, and I don't want to know about that. And that's exactly what I do.
Yeah.
And people are liking it, so I'm happy about it.
Yeah. I think it must have been about 2 years ago I bought your Salala oil. And whether people like it or not, they always notice it. They always say, you're wearing something, what is it? And it just does something. And then I've met people, strangers, and I've said, you're wearing Salala by Evelyn Naon. And they say, yes. And you immediately know you're going to have a lot in common with that person.
Excellent.
So, I mean, there are certain substances which I know are kind of feature a lot in your different oils, although you have a very limited kind of range of oils, which all have big, heavy stories behind them. But, for example, oud is one of them. Could you say a little bit about that? Because I know very little about it.
Oud. Oud is present in all history of religions, let's say. We can talk about oud and it's going to appear on the Bible. It will appear on the Jewish Torah. It will appear in the Muslim Quran. And it will appear in other books of religious history. Why? Because they say, or we think, that it connects to God or to the source, as we want to call it. It's a very deep and profound smell. And also has a very interesting story, because to get oud, you need a fungi to attack a tree. Let's say that there's a storm and a branch of the tree breaks. So this fungi enters, and the tree, to heal, creates the oud.
Wow.
This resin that smells, it's a very mysterious smell, because it can go from the composition of the soil, acidity, smoke, sweetness. It's a very complex scent.
It kind of wakes people up to smell things that they've never even smelt before. It's strange.
Yes, and to appreciate smells that maybe we are not used to appreciate,
mm-hmm.
like a soul in the composition. We can think about that and say, wow, that's not good. No, that's really human.
Mm-hmm.
Eh? It mm-hmm. connects to humanity. And in that sense that it connects us to ourselves, it connects to God or the source. Oud has been used in perfumes since ancient times. You can see, for example, the Temple of Solomon, when he talks about the altar. It talks about oud, it talks about frankincense, about myrrh. If we think about the Mecca in Saudi Arabia, inside Mecca there's oud, it's perfumed with oud. So oud is present in all religions as a scent that connects to the divinity.
Wow, wow. And frankincense and myrrh also feature in your blends.
Yes. Salalah, as you said, Joanna. Salalah was inspired in one of my trips that I went to Oman. I was researching the Phoenician history of Ibiza, and it was connected in a way to Oman, because if you go to the archaeological museum in Ibiza, you can find these incense burners that were brought by the Phoenicians and also produced in Dalvila, because they have a lot of stalls for creating products in Dalvila. And the resins were coming straight from the south of Arabia. That was the Sabian kingdom. And we go back to the Queen of Sheba. They were the exporters of resins, myrrh, and frankincense. So as connecting Ibiza with Salalah, that was the idea with the perfume, I decided to put on the formula like myrrh, frankincense from Oman, lemon from Spain, rose from Morocco, because these Phoenicians were traveling all around, let's say, Red Sea, and then from the area of today, so like Gaza or Palestine, they move through the Mediterranean Sea, moving a lot of stock. Flax perfumes from Egypt, resins from the south of Arabia, cedar wood from Lebanon, silk from the east. They were the expert traders, and they were a very important period of Spain, let's say, or not of Spain, of the history of Spain, the area of the Mediterranean commerce, no?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, they laid the foundations of the island's culture.
Yes, 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 yes.
I mean, I feel like the way that you talk about Ibiza is the identity of Ibiza, which I see as being accurate and true, you know? And all of this is so little known knowledge, public knowledge. You know, through smell, you're telling these stories and bringing them back.
Yeah, there's a lot of research about the history of the island, but it's on books on the university. Mm-hmm. Sometimes information doesn't come out from the that circle of people. Sometimes there's some, let's say, discussions or talks on the museum, but the thing is that the people want to learn about it, but they should communicate in some other language apart from Spanish or Catalan, because I know a lot of people on the island that I've been talking about the perfumes. They would like to understand and would like to know much more about this. But we should expect some little kind of motivation from the I don't know who, Conseil, Ayuntamiento, I have no idea who, but they need to come a little bit stronger to show the history of the island. And for that, you need cross cultures. You need to work with other languages. It's important.
Totally, yeah. If you really have that intent desire of uncovering these secrets, first you have to go through the Catalan barrier. You have to learn Catalan to be able to go to the university lectures and the presentations. And
yeah, in a way, when the island started to get tourism around the 50s or 60s, they thought that the history of the island was not important, that what was important was the sun. The sun is an easy worker, I always say, because it's always present and it never fails to appear. But the people that come to the island, there's many layers of people, and there's people that they really loved and they have interest to know what was happening here before. Because before the discotheques, there was something else. So if we reevaluate and we bring into focus the history of Ibiza, it will be a much better way of marketing the island also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I heard the new person of the from the Conseil, who is in charge of tourism, say that it's one of her priorities to highlight the cultural heritage of the island and put some new actions. So let's see what happens. But yeah, the language is number one to communicate these stories. People want to learn, but they have to be able to understand what they're being taught.
Yeah, and also when there's these talks, they fail to make it public, to make publicity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of like in that bubble, the Ibicenco Catalan bubble. There's so much wonderful culture and talks that I think they're a little bit lazy about it because they are used to it, and they don't realise that for outsiders like us, we have to make a big, big effort to find out about it.
Yeah, let's say that in a way, I think they have a little bit of a low self-esteem when it comes to think about them, about who they are. Before the tourism, the island was a complex area. It was complex, there was not much work, not much food, and they had hard times. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make them better or worse people. So they should be proud of where they come and talk about it.
You mentioned before we started recording that you are investigating or developing a new scent which is inspired by the salt roots. What's that all about?
About the salt trading.
Because salt doesn't really have a smell, does it? So I'm...
Well, there's some yodo, like a yodic scent, that they are related to the sea. But yes, we can have some salt smell, because there's... in the salt smell, you can also have other smells that they are related to the sea.
I can't wait to hear more about that.
Before, the salt was like the white gold. Even the word salary comes from salario, that is from the salt, because they used to be paid with amounts of salt. Mm-hmm. And there was trading routes that they were related to salt. Formentera, for example, and Salinas in Ibiza, they were very, very important for the trading of salt. On the roots of trading. Mm-hmm. So, as I know that there was a lot of slaves working on these productions of salt, and many people that really struggle doing that work that is really hard, I think it's an opportunity to create a scent that will remember these souls and will put them in value again.
Is there any particular place, land, in that part of the world, in the Arabian lands, that is really, that you're feeling a strong connection with at the moment, or that you're investigating?
Yes. That place is Salalah, again. Mm-hmm. Salalah, it's a tribal area, very interesting, because nowadays they still respect tribal solidarity and the way of the people around the area. The people from the mountains, and there's people from Bedouins from the desert. They still live like in ancient times in a way, even though Oman now is modern and they have lots of new resources. Their family life is very intact, and I really like it. Salalah is one of the places that I'm looking at right now. There's a beautiful archaeological site there that was uncovered by the Italian mission in Oman, and that was a castle. That was the Queen Sheba castle for the trading of incense and myrrh.
Wow.
And another area that I would love to go now, and it's that they open the visas to go to Saudi Arabia. And even though some people don't like it because there's a lot of themes that they are very complex there, in terms of me as a researcher, I would like to go to see some areas there, from there, because some areas of Ibiza, they have been made by all these tribes also.
Wow.
The tribes were all from that area.
Wow. Gosh. They're all lands which in modern times have a completely different image or political situation to what you're interested in.
Yes. Yeah, this is the journey of a Jewish girl that one day decided to jump in the middle of the Arabs to see what happens.
So, as many people through history have done, you kind of, you know, have been drawn to all these different places, but then you always seem to return to Ibiza.
Yes.
So how do you feel about Ibiza being that place that you always come back to?
It was a place of, let's say, of discovery of myself, because right there it was, I came as something when I arrived to the island, and I was, I start to change, learn, grow, and understand myself much better. And from there was that I jumped to travel far and wide to these ancient areas from the south of Arabia. But Ibiza has been my home for the last 20 years. So it's a place where I don't know, I feel free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For you and for so many people, it seems like a crossroads where you can be, but you can also be connected to so many different other places.
Yes. And what I love about Ibiza, it's the amount of people from all around the world living together, knowing each other, communicating as we can, in the language we can, and just accepting each other as we are. It's the land for being yourself.
100%. So yet again, what really inspires me about Evelyn's story is how all of her discoveries of these ancient roots and her connection with the Middle East, South Arabia, North Africa, all of that started and opened up to her on Ibiza. That was the cultural crossroads which opened the doors to those distant places. Now, there are many, many more routes which I could touch on, but I'm not going to. This has been a brief introduction, but I have scratched away the final layer of my treasure map anyway. Perhaps yours is much more multi-layered. And the very, very base layer of this treasure map, in the end, has one final set of routes on it, and it is the salt routes. Next to Ibiza's airport, the gateway to the modern-day mass tourism routes, which I touched on right at the beginning of this episode. Next to the airport is Salinas, the salt flats. Weirdly, the island's most modern and most ancient migration routes have their foundations right next to each other on the island. Ibiza's salt has been exported around the world for almost 3,000 years, since the island was first colonised by the Phoenicians. In medieval times, Ibiza salt was supplied to Genoa, Florence and Venice. There's a lot more that I could say about the salt, white gold, as it's often referred to, about how it has really shaped the true identity of this island, even though we hear about it so little. Beneath the glitz, beneath the glamour, beneath the fashion, beneath the trends, there lies white gold, the salt of the earth. That is what has shaped the true identity of this island. And we've just travelled from those modern mass tourism routes of Ibiza to the salt routes. And to round up the journey, I'm just going to mention a little anecdote from an Ibiza-based artist whose work I greatly admire for its mythical, mysterious qualities, Romany Sanchez Smil, who does a much better job than I do of making sure that she avoids the modern-day mass tourism routes that beat their path to the island in the summer season. She's very good at going in the reverse direction and taking herself pretty much as far away as possible during that time. And this year, she decided to go and do an artist residency in the Faroe Islands, which are kind of in the ocean, somewhere between Iceland and Norway, I think. And there she was, developing her artistic practice, more or less falling off the radar, which isn't surprising, considering I think she was living on a sort of rugged mountain, very sparsely populated, surrounded by ocean. And suddenly she put a photograph on social media of her very well wrapped up because of the Scandinavian climate, sat beside two gigantic white sacks, which seemed to be full of some kind of substance. And these sacks had in blue ink Ibiza salt printed on them. It was pretty amazing. She had fled to one of the most remote parts of Northern Europe to escape from the most modern-day migration routes which now connect Ibiza to the rest of the world. And in doing so, she'd stumbled upon the island's most ancient one, the salt route, which I guess can only prove what goes around comes around. You've been listening to The Wells of Tanit, hosted by me, Joanna Ruby. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please spread the word. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a good review. We're very grateful to the Ibizan folk group Uk and their record label Producciones Blau for letting us use the song De Joed Vas Despedient as our theme music. I'll see you next time, and in the meantime, may your island wanderings lead you to those forgotten ancient places where the waters of inspiration always flow, to the wells of Tanit.
No l'he trasmudat de res, dels tractus que els dos teníem. Jo seguiré lo mateix, visquent amb molta alegria. I a conhortat després de lo que mos pervendria, i en sé que no et sé ni et veig, que això et content algun dia. Per això no t'abandon, i has de pensar que t'oblidi, que dins mon cor repeteix lo que em deies aquell dia. Sempre t'apreciaré, i on se fuia que sigues, només per dar-te entenent que de tu estic